Ask the clerk to call the second case.
Court will now call John E. Beaton and Beaton Law Firm LLC versus Margaret Moreno and Law Offices of Stephen M. Johnson. May it please the court, Mr. Brian M. Fant will argue for the appellant. Mr. Grant Norvell will argue for the appellee, Margaret Moreno. Ms. Jennifer Andrews will argue for the appellee, Law Offices of Stephen M. Johnson.
Mr. Fant, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Brian Fant. I've got the privilege today of representing John E. Deaton and his law firm, the Deaton Law Firm. And this is a case involving a special appearance that was denied and is being appealed. And I want to first of all say that what we are requesting is that this court render a judgment and overturn the denial and dismiss the underlying case for lack of jurisdiction. There may be some disputed elements of this case. I think that it would serve us well to talk about those, first of all, that are not disputed. It is not disputed that John E. Deaton is a lawyer who has an LLC named the Deaton Firm, and that both John Deaton individually and the Deaton Firm are both residents of Rhode Island. I think it's also not disputed that the only reason that I'm standing before you today and arguing anything to you today is because Stephen M. Johnson, with his firm here in Fort Worth, reached out to John Deaton in Rhode Island and requested that John Deaton serve as local counsel in Rhode Island. It's also not disputed that all the petitions that were sent to my client, John Deaton, were prepared by Mr. Johnson and sent to Mr. Deaton for signature because Mr. Johnson was not licensed to practice law in Rhode Island. I believe it's also undisputed that my client is not a signatory to any contracts that Mr. Johnson or the Johnson firm had with any of the clients. And they've got before you a couple of blow-ups here with respect to the attorney-client agreement. And if I might refer to that, even though it's not my exhibit, do you mind if I refer to that? Thank you. You see that obviously, he is not a signatory to that agreement. And with respect to this matter, the only reason that John Deaton has any claim to any attorney's fees is because of a contract between John Deaton and the Deaton firm and the Johnson firm. And in the court's record, the contracts are between the firm and the firm, two firms. Now, they've also sued John Deaton individually, which brings an interesting question about whether someone who is a member of an LLC in Rhode Island can in any way personally invoke jurisdiction in Texas. I think it's also undisputed in this case that all of the matters that were filed, and in particular, since we're talking about Ms. Moreno's claim, that her claim was filed in Superior Court in Rhode Island, and all of the actions taken by John Deaton with his firm on behalf of Ms. Moreno occurred in Rhode Island. I think it's also undisputed, and it's in the record because of the transcripts that are part of the court's record, that there arose once Stephen Johnson with his firm had entered into a, I don't know if you want to call it global or aggregate or however you want to term it, he settled with the whole lot of these Kugel Mesh cases. This is involves a class action lawsuit involving a mesh lining and a number of people from all across the country were filing in Rhode Island, both in the state court in Rhode Island and also in federal court under multi-district litigation. But Ms. Moreno's case was in the state court. Once Mr. Johnson settled all of the claims, he, I think it's undisputed, would not, and it's clearly in the record, would not advise Mr. Deaton of the amounts that were settled on behalf of the clients that Mr. Deaton had represented. During the pendency of that, and quite frankly, the record reflects that those matters are still pending in the Superior Court in Rhode Island, where the judge of the Superior Court in Rhode Island is working to resolve those issues, even as we speak, as reflected in the court's record. But when he would not advise of the amounts of the settlement, Mr. Deaton, of course, because he had an entitlement to a percentage of the attorney's fees under his contracts with Mr. Johnson, was concerned about not being told. The defense lawyers would not also tell him, even though he was the attorney of record on the documents in Rhode Island. And so I think that what we're really going to get down to is whether or not the stipulation, which is part of the court's record, and I'm happy to address that, because I don't think that the appellees are really fighting too hard, and I won't speak for them, on the fact that there's really no sufficient minimum contacts with the state of Texas that would invoke specific jurisdiction, and there's certainly no ongoing engagement with the state of Texas that would invoke general jurisdiction. But what they have blown up here, and which I'd like to go ahead and address now, because I think what is disputed, and I think it's clearly not sufficient to invoke jurisdiction, is the stipulation. The first thing that I'd like the court to notice about this, and it's on page 405 of the court's record, is that the stipulation is as to non-disclosure of protected client information. You see, it arose out of the fact that they wouldn't tell him what the settlements were for his clients that he'd been representing. And so he entered into a stipulation that he would not disclose those. Now, ethically, in the state of Texas under 105 of the disciplinary rules, in comment one of the disciplinary rules, an attorney's obligation of confidentiality is not based on a contract with an individual. An attorney's obligation of confidentiality is based on the relationship with that individual, so that one who is just a prospective client comes in and speaks with you. You don't have a contract with them. You never enter into any kind of contract. You have an obligation of confidentiality to that individual, and that's clearly set forth in 105, comment one. So what I think the stipulation is a stipulation of his obligation to his client, Ms. Moreno, to not reveal or to maintain the confidentiality. Now, it is true that when he speaks to the ARA, or the Attorney Representation Agreement, he uses language about wanting benefits of that contingent fee, and that he's owed under the contracts that he's got with Mr. Johnson. But stating that he is entitled to part of the fees is not a consent to jurisdiction in Texas, and it is not a statement of an agreement to be bound by any terms of the contract. Now, what they're arguing really is...
Suppose for a second that this ties Deaton into the ARA.
Well, the case law, fortunately, on this matter, in the Carlisle case, the court deals with whether or not receipt of proceeds from a merger are considered a direct and substantial benefit, justifying a conclusion that direct benefits apply. The direct benefit theory of binding a non-signatory to a contract. And what I'm arguing to you is that he did not sign the contract.
No, I understand all that.
Yes, sir.
What I'm asking you is, if you look at this stipulation and it's interpreted as the appellee interprets it, Deaton was hired pursuant to the ARA, authorized by the ARA, considered an associated counsel pursuant to the translation they adopted the ARA. If you assume that, how does that affect the specific and or general jurisdiction is my question.
Well, the answer to that is that I don't think it would be any different than if Mr. Deaton had a contract that he had signed with Ms. Marino, and the courts have continuously held that the mere existence of a contract with somebody in the state of Texas. So if he adopts the, first of all, he's not adopted, but assuming that he has adopted the contract, that still would not be sufficient minimum contacts under either specific jurisdiction or general jurisdiction to, for this court in Tarrant County to assert jurisdiction over him. That's my point.
A contract like this contract?
Yes, sir. I said a contract.
And your case that says that is?
My case that I'm relying on is the Carlisle case, which speaks to whether somebody is bound by a contract that's not a signatory and what that requires in order for him to be bound. And I know we're talking, I think, for the sake of argument, that let's just assume he has bound himself to this contract. And what my argument is that he has not bound himself to that contract under any theory, that you have to take this in the context that
it's... Okay, so your answer is, I'm not assuming what you're asking me to assume because that's not this case.
That's correct.
As opposed to, okay, it is this case, but it still doesn't hurt your position. That's not what you're saying at all.
Well, I am saying you're correct. But I will say that in this case, there still has to be some consent to jurisdiction.
Well, the contract refers to that, doesn't it? The contract at the ARA refers to that.
It has a, I'm sorry.
No, I'm trying not to interrupt you.
It has a choice of law provision in the contract. But in order for there, I think there's two issues. One is whether or not he has bound himself to an agreement to arbitrate the case. The second issue is whether or not by saying I'm entitled to some of these fees under the ARA, he has subjected himself either to subject matter or general jurisdiction. And I don't believe that the case law supports the fact that somebody says, you know, I think I'm entitled to get paid because of this contract, that that is an assumption of that contract significant enough to assert jurisdiction over him.
One other quick question. The Houston case in federal court that another document refers to, and you're not disputing, that your client represents Ricky Patton.
Yes, sir.
My question was, is there anything in this record that shows that Deaton ever got or his law firm personnel ever got on an airplane, ever went to Houston or anywhere in Texas pursuant to anything here?
No, sir, there is not. That's one of the other
things. That would have only happened if the case had gone to trial.
Correct.
All this other work he did in this case over the course of many months was all done from Rhode Island.
That's correct. And in fact, it's undisputed that Mr. Johnson had settled the case before it had a chance to go to trial in the Houston federal court. What they argue is that, well, there was an expert witness that was retained, and that expert witness happened to be from Texas. But I think that would fall within what this court discussed in length in the Furtech case as one of those isolated, fortuitous kinds of things and not sufficient for general jurisdiction or specific jurisdiction.
Okay, that's your answer to what they're saying?
Yes, my answer to what they're contending is that, well, you hired an expert, and the expert happened to be from Texas, and that alone, the mere hiring of that expert is sufficient to constitute a contact with the state of Texas that would subject them to jurisdiction. And the case law on that, which is in particular the Carlisle case, talks about these that you an isolated event like that, or fortuitous event, does not subject someone to jurisdiction. For example, if I hire an expert from Rhode Island, it doesn't subject me to jurisdiction in Rhode Island, just because the expert happens to be in Rhode Island, because there's experts from multiple states that could have been hired. You just happened to hire the one that was from Texas.
Would it, if your lawsuit was in Rhode Island?
Well, there's a, again, there's a question about specific jurisdiction, whether or not there's sufficient context to subject yourself to the state's laws. And
what I'm really getting at, yes, is, I'm not playing with you, you have a Houston case, it's a very substantial case. He goes to court in Rhode Island and says, I'm the person that is responsible for everything. I've done enormous work, and I've hired this guy who's an expert in Texas. I'm the lawyer for these people. Does that seem to be fortuitous, isolated, or collateral to everything to you, really?
Well, the fact that he was willing to try the case in Texas and was going to try the case in Texas, and that came out, as you'll see in the record, at the last minute, that, hey, why don't you try this case in Texas? No, I don't think that's sufficient in a federal court to say you've subjected yourself to state jurisdiction. So,
Mr. Fan, I see your lights out, but I'd like to have a follow-up question if the court will allow.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was some contention that I read in some of the pleadings filed that there was a act of malpractice committed by the Deaton Law Firm, and that there was a failure to disclose an expert witness or the materials in an expert witness report timely, which caused a difficulty in the prosecution of the patent case. How does that play in your judgment in the question of the special appearance?
Well, the Rhode Island court, first of all, the multi-district court, was handling all of the discovery in Rhode Island. That's undisputed. The actual trial may have been in the Houston Federal District Court, but all of the discovery and all the designations were all before the federal judge in Rhode Island. So if there was a negligence in failing to designate an expert, it still, that negligence occurred in Rhode Island for failing to designate timely to the federal district judge of the federal court in Rhode Island.
So this patent case never pended in a Houston federal court?
Mr. Johnson had originally filed it in the Houston court originally, long before Deaton was ever involved. It was transferred under a multi-district licensing order, litigation order, to be referred to Rhode Island. All of the contact that Mr. Deaton had with that case occurred in Rhode Island.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Blake Norvell. I represent Margaret Marino, the appellee in this matter. I'm from Abilene. Appellees respectfully request that this court affirm the trial court rulings. Judge Evans did not abuse his discretion by denying Appellant Deaton's special appearance. I would like to discuss ripeness and the form selection clause. Ms. Jenny Andrews over here would like to discuss minimum contacts. This case is about an attorney, Appellant John Deaton, who represented Margaret Marino and others in a class action lawsuit, was fired for cause and then chose to breach his fiduciary duty by freezing a class action settlement with a meritless lien, thereby preventing Margaret Marino and hundreds of other seriously injured plaintiffs from receiving settlement checks, all to protect his own interest. And I want you to remember that quote, to protect his own interest, because that's a quote from John Deaton himself. He said he filed a fictitious lien, wouldn't sign the settlement agreements, and did other things after he was fired to protect his own interest or his fee. So simply put, this is a case about a lawyer who's breached his fiduciary duty and committed malpractice by putting his own money ahead of my client, Margaret Marino, and the hundreds of other people who were seriously injured. Ripeness. This case is ripe. I understand appellants contend there's a ripeness issue. There's not. This is a very real injury. Deaton breached a fiduciary duty, and because of his actions, a major class action settlement was delayed for at least 6 months. Real people didn't get had their money delayed because of this. My client, Appley Marino, had her check delayed for at least 6 months because of Deaton's actions. There's nothing futuristic, abstract, or attenuated about this. I mean, the loss of use of money and not getting a settlement check, those are real damages. That's real. So when appellants say that this claim is not ripe, there's absolutely no merit to that. There's nothing theoretical about this injury. Now, let's talk about the form selection clause. It's very simple. I mean, this case is very simple. It can be resolved easily. This is how. Deaton consented to the jurisdiction in Texas. End of story. If you'll notice, we have the attorney representation agreement, and this is the authority by which, as a lawyer, Deaton is operating. And the attorney representation agreement contains a form selection clause mandating arbitration in Texas and Texas law. So that's the first thing, and that's one of our exhibits. And the second thing, which is very important, and that's on the board right over there, it's the stipulation. So if there's any doubt that Deaton's subject or has agreed to the Texas jurisdiction, one only has to read the stipulation. And it says it right there, plain English, black and white. It says that Deaton was hired pursuant to the attorney representation agreement, and he agrees to all the terms of it. And that is actually signed by Deaton himself. So therefore, he's bound by it. And third, even if it were the case, even if we didn't have all this, Deaton is still bound by that attorney representation agreement. Here's why. It comes down to the doctrine of direct benefits estoppel. And what direct benefits estoppel means, when you seek benefits under a contract, or you seek to benefit from a contract, you have to take the contract as a whole. In other words, you have to take what you like about the contract, and you have to take what you don't like about the contract, but you have to take the whole contract. So what's happening here is Deaton is coming in under this contract saying he's entitled to a lot of money in attorney's fees. But while he sits up in Rhode Island, he's also trying to tell this court, notwithstanding the fact he seeks attorney's fees, he also believes that he shouldn't be bound by the arbitration agreement within that contract. And that directly contracts the doctrine of direct benefits estoppel. If Deaton's going to come in and he's going to say, I'm entitled to receive money under this contract, he has to take the whole contract, and that contract clearly states that that there's an arbitration agreement, the case is going to be arbitrated in Texas, and Texas law applies. So simply put, it's well-established law in Texas that form selection clauses are valid. If there's a form selection clause, and it's generally going to be upheld in Texas. That's from the Texas Supreme Court and most of the appellate courts. So that's what it comes down to. Form selection clauses are valid. I'll point out that under the Federal Arbitration Act, arbitration agreements do not have to be signed. They just have to be in writing and agreed to. That's undisputed. And another point is, personal jurisdiction is not required to enforce a form selection clause. That's clearly the law, and I would point the court to a case. It's called International Energy. It's from the Fifth Circuit, 818 Federal 3rd, 193 Fifth Circuit, 2016, and that's consistent with that ruling. There's another case from one of our appellate courts in Houston. It's Guam International Services, and both those cases stand for the proposition that to enforce an arbitration clause, one does not require minimum contacts. So the bottom line is, if this court looks at the arbitration clause in the agreement, concludes it's valid, sees that Deaton signed it, Judge Evans has the authority to refer that case to arbitration in Texas regardless of if there's minimum contacts. Because when you have a form selection clause, the issue of minimum contacts becomes irrelevant. Minimum contacts would only matter if the court, for some reason, concluded the form selection clause was not valid. For those reasons, appellees respectfully requesting that this court affirm Judge Evans' ruling to deny Deaton's special appearance and allow us to go back into Judge Evans' court and get Judge Evans to send this case to arbitration. Again, Appellee Marino, we're not trying to try this case in Judge Evans' courtroom. We're just merely trying to get Deaton into the arbitration. And that goes back to that theory. When there's a form selection clause, there's a much lower standard for a district court judge to send a case to arbitration. And that's the bottom line. Deaton agreed to this. So he's in court now. He's trying to renege on his agreement. It's attorney for Marino, I honored the arbitration clause. I filed this suit, and I didn't contest or dispute the arbitration clause, and neither should Deaton. Thank you very much.
May it please this honorable court, Mr. Fant and Mr. Norville. I represent Stephen Johnson and his law firm. We are here to discuss, as you've heard, our special appearance. I will confine my comments due to the time limitations, of course, unless the court has questions, to whether or not there are specific jurisdiction over Mr. Deaton and his law firm, and the answer is unequivocally yes. In addition to the forum selection clause, which Mr. Deaton, whether he likes it or not, agreed to by seeking benefits under all of these clients' contracts, including Ms. Moreno's, Mr. Deaton met all the criteria under Texas long-arm statute and federal due process to satisfy specific jurisdiction under the Texas law under which we are guided here today. Why? He contracted with the Texas resident, Stephen Johnson, and through him, at least 13 other Texas residents for whom he served as local counsel in Rhode Island. He contracted with Stephen Johnson not once, but three times, and the latter two I would submit to this court are evidence of the 7 years of ongoing, continuous, systemic communications back and forth between Mr. Johnson, a Texas resident, and Mr. Deaton, a Rhode Island resident, that actually satisfy minimum contacts under the rationale of Burger King and this court's opinion in Nordstrom versus Secur, which came out last year. Are there systemic, does this contract contemplate a long-term, continuous, and detailed relationship? It most certainly did, because in mass torts like this and with respect to both counsel, this was not a class action. These were individual lawsuits, individually filed, not in a class action. There's no way to know when these mass tort type of proceedings, which are quite unwieldy and also found in multiple venues, Illinois, federal MDL, state court Rhode Island, are going to end. And so, therefore, by entering into this local council agreement, this wasn't a one-off. This wasn't an isolated situation. And Mr. Deaton proved that over the next 7 years, where we had hundreds, if not thousands, of communications back and forth between Mr. Johnson and Mr. Deaton about management of those cases. Mr. Deaton also contracted with a Texas resident, as the court is well aware, to provide valuation services for the Bellwether trial, Mr. Patton's trial in Houston. That absolutely meets one of the criteria under long-arm statute. And I believe that the contract itself or the contracts themselves, the first one in 2008 for local counsel, which was a unilateral reach out, the second one, however, in 2012, where Mr. Deaton renegotiated his contract with my client, Stephen Johnson, developing now, instead of 5% of attorney's fees of clients, of recovery from clients like Ms. Moreno, but now 10% on Mr. Deaton's letterhead. And in addition, signed within this practically the same day, the referral agreement for the patent case where Mr. Deaton asked for and got 2/3 of any attorney fee recovery in the event of a favorable judgment. And I'll talk about that bellwether trial in a minute. But all of those matters, initiating discovery in Texas for Mr. Patton's bellwether trial, even though it didn't actually take place, is, I submit, doing business in Texas that actually not only meets Texas long-arm statute, but also minimum contacts. Because there is no requirement, I have found none, that the purposeful availment criteria of federal due process means that the outcome for which you are initiating your contact toward the forum, the non-resident defendant, actually has to have an outcome that you like or actually come to fruition. But the fact remains, what did Mr. Deaton do in his focused attempt toward Texas? So did his conduct, both in the 7-year continuous systemic relationship back and forth, renegotiating contracts, demanding more of a share of client contracts like Ms. Moreno, all of them involving the Rhode Island plaintiffs, for instance, require him to come down to Texas to litigate his dispute with this client, whom he did have an attorney-client relationship? And the answer is yes. Why? His contacts were purposeful. He had contacts with Texas. They arise from and relate to the causes of action which have been asserted here, and they satisfy fair play and substantial justice. And so why, therefore, is that bellwether trial, among other considerations, relevant and material to the causes of action raised here? Obviously, Mr. Patton is not before the court. However, it is well settled that bellwether trials, and I know the court's familiar with those, are benchmarks. They set valuation standards for a group of other product liability or other type of large litigation. And as a result, Mr. Deaton and his law firm undertook not only a direct attorney-client relationship to Mr. Patton to try his case as a reasonable and prudent attorney, but also fiduciary relationship to the group as a whole, including Ms. Moreno, to undertake to obtain the best possible result that he could. There are vicissitudes of trial, but there are vicissitudes that can be avoided, like make your expert designation deadline and don't just get your case almost dismissed with prejudice. Instead, it got put on the shelf, administratively closed, fortunately, and with due respect, that case occurred in 2012, and Mr. Johnson ultimately negotiated a settlement with one of the general counsel of the defendant manufacturer in 2014. So that case was disposed of and basically stacked off into the closet until 2 years before Mr. Johnson negotiated the settlement, which is one of the issues here. That case and other breaches of fiduciary duty, which are articulated in our pleadings, form the basis of not only, perhaps not a legal malpractice case against Mr. Deaton, but breach of fiduciary duties, which we have alleged, both Ms. Moreno and myself, on behalf of Mr. Johnson, are not necessarily governed, but are informed by the conduct of an attorney that can be measured by malpractice standards. So did Mr. Deaton breach fiduciary duties not only to Ms. Moreno but to my client, Stephen Johnson, and his firm, as well as a large number of mesh clients? The answer is we contend that is, and those operative facts in part arose from his conduct, Mr. Deaton's, in Texas, going to try this case. He didn't have to try Patton. Pardon me. He didn't have to try Patton. He agreed to do that. And he, as this court is well aware, as cases have held, attorneys who come to Texas to try cases are actually found to have purposefully availed themselves of the benefits of doing business within this state. Thank you, Your Honor. We request the court affirm Judge Evans.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Fant, rebuttal?
Thank you. I want the court to, or I'd like to draw the court's attention to a really critical point that is being missed here. And that is that specific jurisdiction, as this court stated in the FearTech case, is established if the defendant's alleged liability arises out of or is related to an activity conducted within the forum. What they're arguing is that the liability that they're alleging, and of course this court doesn't have, it's not based on merits of any claim. That's not relevant, whether the case has merits or not. But it has to be related to activity conducted within the forum. The activity that they're complaining about was conducted in Rhode Island. So there is no specific jurisdiction because they're, for that reason alone. Then when they start talking about the length of time and the...
Before you leave that thought,
yes, sir.
Sir, I'm troubled by the language that is in this stipulation as to non-disclosure. That's number over there on our page 405.
Yes, sir.
Because it reads, as I see this, it reads as though Mr. Deaton was signing this stipulation, which contains within it language which specifically ties his activities to the ARAs, because if he didn't have a referral fee, then he wouldn't be entitled to any money for any work that he would have been doing, because his only involvement in terms of his authority to act as an attorney in this whole transaction results from the ARAs that were signed up by Mr. Johnson and with the clients. And then a part of that, the contingent fee, would be the basis of referral agreements that Mr. Deaton signed with Mr. Johnson. So if you don't have a tie back and become a party to the ARA, then you don't have any right to any fees, unless you take the next stair step and say you gave me a referral of those parts of those contingent fees, and that's why I'm entitled to the money that I'm saying you owe me this much, and they say, no, we don't. We don't owe you anymore. We owe you this much. So when that's within that framework and you get to the stipulation, it says in the stipulation that John Deaton and the Deaton Law Firm was hired pursuant to the ARA and authorized by the ARA to act as counsel for clients in the Superior Court of Rhode Island and the U.S. District Court. And Deaton seeks benefits of the ARA contingency fee to recover a portion of the contingent fee. I don't know how you get around that being, okay, I'm putting my arms around this ARA.
Well, I think three things. One is, if the case law in Texas is that simply contracting with someone in Texas is not sufficient to subject you to personal jurisdiction in Texas. Let's think about that just a minute. The only reason you contract with somebody, like an electrical contractor who contracts with somebody within the state of Texas, is so that he gets paid money from that contract. So the contract that is, you know, in a referral agreement, Mr. Deaton is not entitled to one penny of the attorney's fees, regardless of the Marino contract with Johnson. He is only entitled to any percentage of fees based on his contracts with Mr. Johnson, not regardless of the verbiage. I dare say Mr. Johnson would argue, wait a minute, if I don't have a referral contingent fee agreement with this guy in Rhode Island, he's not entitled to any part of this contract. The only reason he's entitled to any part of this contract is because of the agreements I have made with him. And I would argue that's not materially different from any contract you enter into with anyone in the state of Texas where you're going to get money from that contract. In fact, I think it's a step beyond that, because his recovery is contingent on this local attorney being paid. And so really, I think you, in order to hold that that is sufficient for personal jurisdiction in Texas, I think it establishes, if I may, case law that would say any attorney within the United States that is referred a case from a Texas resident and is getting a percentage of the Texas resident's case based in the contract, that he's subject to Texas jurisdiction. So that alone.
I think you're overlooking the fact of the forum selection clause.
And let me address that. Thank you. I'd like the court to pay to look at the Carlisle case. Excuse my vernacular. In Carlisle Bank Shares, they had the same kind of situation where non-signatories to a merger agreement wanted to get paid from the merger agreement. They had not signed that agreement. It was the same argument in Carlisle that this direct benefits estoppel theory, which you've heard, applies, and that because of that, they are bound to the arbitration clause. And what the court said is that this direct benefits estoppel theory, which was developed in the context of arbitration clauses, applies when a non-signatory knowingly exploits the agreement containing the arbitration clause. But, as the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has said, direct benefits estoppel is, quote, seriously considered only when the signatory has brought suit against a signatory, when the non-signatory has brought suit against a signatory premised on the agreement. It's the only time, according to Carlisle, that this benefit agreement or this direct benefit theory of binding someone to a contract is really taken seriously. There is no evidence that my client has sued anyone or that my client is trying to get out of the contracts he's entered into with Mr. Johnson. And finally, and if I may, I respond to the last thing. The court in Carlisle recognized that the receipt of proceeds, and I would say, or the entitlement to receipt of proceeds from the merger contract that they were not a signatory to, did not constitute direct and substantial benefits justifying a conclusion that direct benefits applies, and therefore under the contract that they were bound by the forum selection. I believe they addressed that clearly in that case. Thank you.
Mr. Fant, Mr. Norvell, Ms. Andrews, thank you very much for your arguments
thank
here
you.
Today. We appreciate them. Your case is submitted, and you are free to go about your business.